This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by the wonderful patrons of Trek FM, who support us through Patreon. If you love Star Trek discussion, visit patreon.com/TrekFM to find out how you can help and even become part of the team. That's patreon.com/Trek.FM. And we thank everyone for their support.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to Continuing Mission, our look at the way fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Tony Robinson, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series or independent productions that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe, or in the case of this episode, involve actors that have made a permanent impression in Star Trek by creating a unique and lasting character. In this episode, I'm joined by Manu Intiraimi, the very talented actor whose last name is the name of the Incan god of the sun. If ever a remake of The Royal Hunt of the Sun is made, then Manu would be perfect for the role. Of course, we all know and love Manu as his alter ego Icheb on Star Trek Voyager. His other works include major supporting roles on such TV series as One Tree Hill and 24 and Las Vegas. As part of a growing band of actors forged by their links to Star Trek, Manu has embraced the genre of the independent Star Trek fan film productions by appearing in the recent Renegade series, along with co-stars Tim Ross and Robert Beltran from Star Trek Voyager, Terry Farrell, Siroc Lawton, Hannah Hatte, and Aaron Eisenberg from Deep Space Nine, Gary Graham from Enterprise, and not forgetting Nichelle Nichols and Walter Koenig from the original TV series and the first of an ever-expanding universe of Star Trek major motion pictures since 1979. Now he's bringing something bold and vibrant to the table, a new venture called The Circuit. So let's get into the turbo lift and go and meet with Manu Intiraimi, where fun will now commence. So hi Manu, welcome to Continuing Mission.
Welcome to that. I'm glad to be here. The turbo lift was a little funky there, though. I don't know. You might want to look into it.
We've got some engineers on it right now. It's been playing up. Borg implants, can you recommend them?
No, I don't recommend them. I don't highly recommend them. I mean, they're good. They're good for some things, but the thing is, once you get them, you're kind of stuck with them. It's like a tattoo, you know. So if you're going to get the implant, you better really, really be passionate about that implant. Otherwise, the process of taking them off is no fun. No fun at all.
Well, I don't know what kind of medical care they have on the planet you originally came from.
Well, that's the worst thing about implants is in implanting them. It's just not, it just doesn't feel good. They knock you out for the procedure, sort of like they do your teeth. But when you wake up, it's a long recuperative period.
I thought it was when you got assimilated, some Borg guy came along and said, this won't hurt a bit. And you kind of went, okay. And then it hurt like hell.
Yeah, it hurt a lot. We are the Borg. This won't hurt a bit.
Yeah, that's right. Lying Toregs. Manu, you're working on a fantastic series, which we're going to get to later. And you've launched this amazing new venture called The Circuit. But before we get there, I'm going to just do a kind of an arc bringing you from kind of early days right up to the present day, and we'll run through some of those items. But obviously everybody knows you from Voyager. You played Icheb on an episode, and then your character continued and they developed the storyline for you, and an incredible storyline where you ended up being infected with a virus and you were all perfectly happy to go off and get reassimilated, and then the idea was that the Borg would die. But that was a huge moral question. Do we allow your parents to kill you, or do we allow you to kill a whole race?
I don't really want to get heavily into that, but what did you think of that at the time, or what did you?
I still think about that episode, honestly. That's the what I like about Star Trek so much, and why I'm a fan of, and I don't want to use this as a plug, but the thing I'm doing now, The Circuit, is an anthology series that each episode is a standalone episode, its own story. And what I like about science fiction so much is that, and Star Trek originally was more of an anthology series in the beginning. It was standalone stories more than like your typical television show where it's an arc throughout the season that you tell a story throughout the season. And that particular episode that you can continue to ask these moral questions that are deep and hard, and they look into who we are as a society, as a species, as a I like asking questions that are difficult to answer. Sometimes in life, there are choices. You get put into a place where neither decision is a very good one, and what do you do then? And life is filled with those difficult moral dilemmas. And sci-fi is such a cool way to look at through metaphor, which kind of knocks people's walls of prejudice down, and they'll watch an episode and they won't even truly realize that they were affected by what the story was really trying to say. That particular episode, I still think about to this day because I think it was one of the darkest episodes in the history of Star Trek.
Oh yeah. I mean, you watch the show and it's just entertainment, and it's a kind of a, what's happening here? There's kind of action, there's tension, but underneath it all, there's this question of there's a morality play going on.
Yeah.
Gosh, they really put you in the deep end.
But what was it? What do you think? Because to me, this has been a thing that for 20 years, I guess, that's bothered me close to it. Usually, a great Star Trek episode that's asking a moral question is actually talking about something that's happening in society today. And I've never been able to put my finger on what that episode was all about for real, because, you know, these people, not only do they send their child off once to try to protect their planet and sacrifice its life, but then when they get him back, they do it again. And that's what they do. And in general, their only weapon against the Borg was to sacrifice their children in order to protect their planet. Although interesting and dark and what was that about in our society at the time that they were looking at? I've never been able to answer that question. I don't know.
Yeah, my own opinion is that it started out as a great premise, an idea. Here's an opportunity to get rid of a species that, you know, no one else has found a way of doing it, because they always have this way of adapting, and whatever you try, you're wasting your time. You're going to end up assimilated or dead, one or the other. But so I guess as a storyline, the writers had this idea that, oh, here's a good idea and let's run with it. But by the time they got three quarters in, they realized, oh, hang on, we've gone down an avenue now that's going to be impossible to back out of. And they kind of ended it, kind of leaving it hanging.
I think nobody died in the end,
but.
No, but those kids do. And they left that planet alone, and they let those people continue to do what they do, which is sacrifice their children. They just said, and then they left. And they didn't stop them from genetically engineering. And here's the question, it just hit me while you were talking. I think the deeper meaning to that episode is war and what nations will do over and over again. They will continue to sacrifice their children in the name of their nation. And how dark is that? And I think that was just a look at, not only will you sacrifice one, but you'll sacrifice another, and you'll sacrifice another, and you'll sacrifice another. And when are we going to stop battling and sacrificing our kids in the name of war and an enemy?
You know, from an episodic point of view, it was kind of strange because we're rooting for the crew of Voyager every week. We want to get them home. We want them to survive. We want them to move on. We don't really want them to come up against brick wall hard decisions like this, but when they do, they have to deal with it, and by proxy we have to deal with it too. we have to answer the questions that are being asked, and we have to put ourselves in the shoes of the crew of Voyager and deal with those issues. We come away and we end up in other people's homes over coffee or a beer, and we discuss what's been going on in that show, you know, and how it affects us. But that was a really...
You know what was really, really brilliant about that show was that there was a woman, and oh man, it's a really tragedy and unfortunate that I don't remember her name. I'll look it up. But the woman who played my mother gave an outstanding performance in that episode. And she cried like 35 times in a row, I remember, during one of the scenes. But when I watched that episode, during the end, Seven and the captain are having a conversation with the parents about what they're doing is wrong. And the mother is looking right into camera and says, without, you know, what we do, there is no planet. You know, this is like, I forget what she says, but it's a great line. And she's so convinced and thoroughly that if we didn't sacrifice one of our kids every once in a while, we would have no society. We would have no people. This is our only defense, and you're taking it away from us. She was so powerful that I don't think without that strong of an actress in that role, just one guest star role, that I don't think that episode would have been as powerful as it was.
Mm.
She was great.
Maybe in some future show, we'll find out what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on a little bit.
I'm sorry, but I thought it was such a great thing that it was a bummer that we only had two seasons to look at it. But this idea of you were bred to kill Borg through a virus, and there was the virus in your bloodstream that could wipe them out if you were to get it into their main network. I thought it was really neat.
Yeah, there were a lot of unanswered questions on that show as well. Yeah. I wonder how they tested how did they know that the virus would work? Because once they tried it, it would immediately go through the hive nodes, things, whatever, and everyone would die anyway. So,
what was neat too is that, like, why did the three children or the four children survive it? You know, they were half Borg by the end of it. And who knew if the people on the planet even realized that there was a possibility that the virus could destroy the ship and then leave their children sort of half Borg, half their children, you know?
Borglings.
Yeah.
How old were you when you decided that you wanted to come into acting? Did you make a conscious decision that acting was the life you wanted to lead?
Yeah, I'm one of those either lucky people or cursed people, whichever way you want to look at it, that's known what I've wanted to do since I was very, very young. I was 4 years old. I was watching a play in McCall, Idaho, and it was Peter Pan. And I remember at that age consciously watching the play, and as soon as the people started having happy thoughts, they were on wires and they started flying around the stage. I remember sitting there going, I want to do that. I want to be them. I want to be an actor. And at five, I think I went and did a community theater thing, played Tom Sawyer. And from that age on, I moved around a lot as a kid. My parents were 60s road hippies. And so we were at different communes and campgrounds, and they were 60s generation folks through and through. So everywhere we stopped, I would get involved in community theater and do some play somewhere. And the whole time I was begging my parents to move to Los Angeles, but that was the last place that they wanted to go. So at 17, I moved out here as soon as I graduated high school and started acting.
Did they have a plan for you? Did they sort of see your talents, as so to speak, and say, you know, you should pursue this? And did they encourage you to get into acting?
My parents were, like I said, they were sort of, I love them to death, but they were very not atypical parents. They didn't, what was the word you just used? Did they
encourage you?
They didn't encourage me, nor did they discourage me. They were just sort of, they believed, you know, their whole philosophy was, you're not our son, you're our friend. Make some choices, live your life. We're not going to tell you what's right and what's wrong. They're proud of what I've accomplished, but they never were like, we're going to be there for you through and through, and no matter what. But I think my parents are proud of me, and I love them, and they love me. But I don't see them as like, no, they didn't go out of their way to send me to the best acting schools or you know, anything like that. But they were okay with my choices. They didn't try to stop me.
Hey, well, I think you made some great choices. So it turned out that way. What about life after Star Trek? You continued on in acting, but you went on to create a memorable character in One Tree Hill. And then later on, you appeared in 24. And were you pretty established by this time? Were your agent was lining you up for roles?
Well, you know what's very strange about the acting profession in general? I don't care who you are, unless even the A-list actors, you never know when your last role is going to be. And it doesn't really matter how many things you put on your resume or how many good roles you do. I mean, I've done a bunch of performances in a lot of television and a lot of film that people haven't seen or didn't, or some people have, but you know, I've got about 60 credits, including the couple of television shows that I was a reoccurring regular on. But you never know. It's, you know, I've got 7 or 8 projects coming out this year, but I still never know when my next job is going to be. And it's sort of this constant hustle of that word established as an actor is a really tricky word. I think you don't actually ever get to a place where you're happy as an actor. I know a bunch of famous actors that are what you would consider movie stars that are friends of mine. And when I talk to them, they're still in their minds, they're still like, well, my name doesn't completely greenlight a picture. I might be famous and I might be worth value to a film, but just because I'm in it doesn't mean that they're going to go get the money to make it. I have to be with 3 or 4 or 5 other movie stars for people to get the project done. And I think all actors are looking to be that Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Cruise type, where just your name in and of itself gets a project made. That's what I would call established. until then, you know, I go from job to job, and I'm blessed and lucky enough for the last, you know, 16, 18 years, and very much humble to the Star Trek and the sci-fi fan base for letting me not work a 9-to-5 job and letting me make these independent films and letting me go from acting job to acting job. And the few times that I thought, oh my God, I might have to go do some hot tar roofing for a while till I find another gig, there was always that Star Trek convention somewhere to go to and get a little paycheck and hang out with the fans. And that's been the most blessed, coolest part of being a part of that series is the loyalty of the fan base. They've always shown me a lot of love, and, you know, close to, I think it's 16 or 17 years later, they still do. And it's allowed me to make movies and do TV and focus on just that as you know, that's my passion in life. And I've been lucky enough to get to do it. And
they say the Star Trek fan base is something in the region of around 50 million people around the world. So there's a lot of people to entertain there.
Did you say 50?
I heard there was around 50 million Star Trek fans around the globe.
Yeah, at least, I would think. And it's incredible every time I get to meet one. That's been the neatest thing about running this Kickstarter campaign is, and the last Kickstarter campaign for Fifth Passenger, which is a film that we did 2 years ago, in about 5 or 6 weeks we're going to be finished. And it's going to be such a joy for me. I'm very proud of the work we did. And the fan base gave us the first 100,000 to get that movie started. And it's really exciting because we're going to get to show it to them pretty soon. And it's just such a neat process, this crowdfunding, because you get to, you talk to thousands and thousands of people to try to get the crowd to get on board with the project. And you end up only getting a couple thousand people that actually open up their wallet and give something to get it made. But they spark the whole creative beginning to the film. And then it's usually what people in crowdfunding don't know is usually that first initial money, you know, like Fifth Passenger is going to come out. And I think there's going to be millions of people out there that see it and think, wow, they did this for $100,000. That's absolutely not the case. You know, it's a starting, the fans spark the initial funds. And when you have a script and you have actors and you have a great story and you have $100,000, you're then taken seriously by the Hollywood machine, and you go out and you match funds and you get involved with other production companies. And we were able to make that film for many times over what we raised on the crowdfunding. And then we get to release it. So it's really exciting. I hope everybody enjoys Fifth Passenger. I don't know how I stumbled us to that place, but I hope everybody likes it.
I'm sure they will. Renegades was cool.
Yeah, Renegades was fun too.
Yeah. What were your initial thoughts about Star Trek fan movies in general, given that they're amateur productions, non-professional, some involving professional people or people involved in the profession of, you know, whether they be writers or technicians or actors, but in essence, amateur productions to, you know, from the outset. What was your initial thought when someone said, you know, hey man, we've got a role for you here?
There, not to offend anybody, but there were many Star Trek fan films that I turned down only because, not because I think I'm above those people or what they were doing. I think I loved watching the stuff that they were doing, but there is a certain sense that when you have reached, like you said, a certain place in the acting world, if you go backwards and you start doing amateur productions, which I've made the mistake of a couple times, even outside of the Star Trek world, it can end up damaging your career. So every time, but I love them. I loved that there were 50 Star Trek productions. I think there was like 11 years there where the Star Trek fan base or something had no new Star Trek coming their direction. And it really filled a gap and allowed us to keep watching Star Trek in a bunch of different forms. I think Gene would have loved it. You know, I think he would have been all about it. His thing was, you know, infinite diversity, infinite combinations, right? I think he would have been thrilled that there were 50 different Star Trek productions of all different kinds. And I think he would have been bummed out about, you know, what ultimately ended up happening and the rules that are in place now. I thought it was cool, you know, but so that's why I decided to do Renegades in the midst of all that craziness and all that drama that was going on about doing Renegades. But I had to do it because I love Walter Koenig, and the story was probably going to be his last. Even though Renegades is not a Star Trek production now, it's still very much Walter Koenig. It has the essence of Walter's character in there, and I thought the story was great, and I had to participate in it just to be a part of his, possibly his final Star Trek film, even though it's not Star Trek.
I'm sure there's a lot of life left in Walter yet. And we all might get surprises one day. Just going back on the fan film production, my thoughts were that actors, maybe professional and non-professional, are all part of a special family of people who have a vision for something or a desire to project a character, you know, and whether you're part of a professional community or whether you're not, you've still got that core within you. And it's great for people to step out and put on a uniform and and do something.
I think it was really, really, really neat. And I don't understand, truthfully, why Paramount would, even if, you know, somebody raised a ton of money to make a Star Trek film. It was sad to see the end of it all because, like I said, I think Gene would have really loved it. I know at the time, Rod was a big fan, Gene's son. I did a movie with him called Instant that should be out pretty soon, a short film that was really beautiful. I got to know Rod, and this was 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, he thought it was great. And also it was a platform where up and coming people that wanted to get into film could raise a little bit of money, learn a little bit about building sets and make their own realities and learn and get better at the craft and at what they do. And I've seen some people from the Star Trek fan film world that have since graduated on to working in bigger and better things, because they got their foot in the door that way. So, I'm a big fan of all of it. I wish that it was still, I think now with the rules that are in place, it's pretty hard to make quality sci-fi or quality Star Trek stuff with how all the things that you have to follow.
Well, it looks like the Borg have infiltrated the powers that be and everybody has to adapt.
Yeah.
God, I hate myself when I come out with these.
No, so I, you know, that's what we're doing, right? So that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm adapting.
You're adapting.
The Kickstarter that I'm doing now is we took all of these incredible Star Trek icons, science fiction icons, stars of today, fantasy, science fiction, horror, etc., and we decided to make this city called Urbiesa, this large mega city that's national parks fit within it. And 10 stories will happen within this city, 10 science fiction stories that have the Star Trek ethic, that have the conscious, intelligent, morality play ethic in them, and bring that back to big budget sci-fi television. That's what we're all about at the Circuit Urbiesa. And these are all guys that you know and you love, from Doctor Who to Star Trek to Defiance to Babylon 5 to all those shows. And now we're trying to just take the Star Trek label off of it. It's not Star Trek. It's something bold. It's something new. And hopefully the fan base will come across and support that as much as they did the Star Trek fan films.
Was the Circuit originally a Star Trek concept and then realigned to, you know, to be something more sci-fi, more generally sci-fi rather than Star Trek sci-fi?
Originally, the Circuit started out as me and Walter were sitting in a diner a couple of years ago with a writer friend of mine, and we decided we wanted to get a project together that could benefit the fans and be a thank you to the fans for their loyalty and their commitment to us throughout our careers. And at the same time, be something that we really wanted to do and we could have fun with. And so we decided that we were going to tell 10 stories that took place behind the scenes of a Star Trek convention or a science fiction convention, and that each story would be a different genre. And that rapidly changed over time that changed into what it is now. And I think what it is now is a lot more exciting than that. And the reason for the change is right around that time when we were about to launch and get things together and start finding funding for the project, Con Man came out with Alan Tiddick and Nathan Fillion and was hugely successful. And people, and that was what was too similar to what we were doing, which was, behind the scenes of a convention TV show. So we got together and we spent 6 months rehashing and coming up with another idea. And I think the idea we have now is much more fun and also has some purpose and some cause behind it to bring back, you know, intellectual, a positive, better art for a better tomorrow type of science fiction that I think is missing from a lot of the science fiction on today. For instance, there's a show called Black Mirror that came out of England that I really love. but it's all dark. It's just dystopian and dark. And like, it's a fantastic show. So we want to do something in the vein of Black Mirror meets Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories meets The Twilight Zone, but have some light and some hope and some and play with some genres. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw your one of the promo videos, which was emulating The Twilight Zone or The Outer Limits. And I was just wondering if the stories will take on that feel where they start off, you're on a lonely road in the middle of the desert and something happens and it all seems normal and ends up incredibly weird. You're not on a lonely road. You're in a bottle on a shelf in somebody's library, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I was always a gigantic fan since I was a kid of anthology television series, Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Outer Limits, everything you just mentioned, plus more. And we want to, the cool thing about the Circuit Urbiesa is it's going to be 10 different science fiction stories that all take place in this large mega city of Urbiesa, but each story will be a separate subgenre of science fiction. So we'll get to see a new director's take on this city through the lens of a new genre. So not only will we have these fun Twilight Zone-like, Outer Limit-like stories, but we'll also be able to see this world that we live in change a little bit compared to what the subgenre is. Because if we're watching a story that takes place in Urbiesa that is a science fiction thriller, it's going to look a whole lot different than if we watch a story in Urbiesa that's a science fiction romance or a science fiction comedy or a science fiction horror supernatural story. So the colors and the so much the city will be tweaked a little bit. The world will be tweaked for the genre tweak, and we'll get to know this wonderful, amazing place and all that happens within it and how these stories affect each other, which we're having a lot of fun with. But we'll also get to see the world change every time, just a little, you know.
And you're inviting people to submit stories, but you're, am I right or wrong? I'm getting the idea that you're blending the professional actors and technicians and whatever, but inviting non-professional people to come and participate as well and add to the mix.
Yeah, that's the whole idea of the story is I've taken in the last 20 years of working in Hollywood, I've taken the most talented people I know and put them on this project. So we have, you know, the CG artists from Star Wars Rogue One and Iron Man and the Disney Planes franchise. And they just recently oversaw Flash and DC's Legends of Tomorrow and Arrow. We have great young directors, Ryan Eggold, who just released his first film at Tribeca. He also plays Tom Keen in NBC's the Blacklist Redemption. We have James Byrd. We have incredibly talented writer, director, actor, producers, CGI, director of photography, et cetera. But it's a very small team. It's like 15 of us. And so for every episode that we finance, either on Kickstarter or through the private sector, if we get a deal with Netflix or Amazon, et cetera, we're staying very hard to the idea that we're going to bring 10 fans on to every episode to come and work in different departments. 5 that are completely amateur, that just want to learn about filmmaking and learn about a particular department, whether it's wardrobe or camera or set design or digital effects or practical makeup effects or whatever. And then we're going to bring 5 people on that have some sort of something to offer as far as they're making films in their particular part of the world or their art fits what we're doing. And so for every episode, it's going to be a collaboration between the fan base and the professionals and celebrities. And we're going to get together and create this world called Urbiesa. And I think it's an amazing dream. And we're this close to accomplishing it. If we get 600 more pledges or something like that, where I can match funds and I can make this for a couple million instead, I can finance the whole series. So it's 600 more people, and we're in a place that we're gonna be able to bring hundreds of fans in and make episodes instead of an episode. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I've been watching the figures rise on Kickstarter, and you know, it's always incredible that you hit your goal just as you thought you might, or and then you've exceeded it. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see the figures. It looks like you could double your initial goal. At this time of recording, I see we've got about 12 days left.
Yeah.
But it looks likely that you'll go quite very, very high on the goal. And that's great. And it's wonderful to see.
We're really pushing people out there to try to hit this 200K, because a friend of mine is willing to match funds if we get there, because that's his magic number. He's like, if you raise $200,000, I think that shows that there's a desire for this show out there. I'll match those funds. We'll add, I just worked with a couple of A-list actors on a incredible film. They're both interested, but we can't afford them until we get that kind of money either. But then getting them aboard the project makes film finance companies excited about it. So we're 12 days away from two great outcomes, which is either we raise 200K and we finance this whole series and we end up on one of the streaming platforms or HBO or something like that next year, or we get one incredible episode that the fans gave their money to, and we try to take that episode and bring that to the networks and use that as a pilot, a starting off point. Either thing is pretty cool, but of course we're pushing to try to get to that 200K miracle number. And if we don't get there, we're still going to make something beautiful, and the fans will love it, and we'll keep building on it from there.
Has the pilot script has been written and developed, or you know, is in development?
Yes, we have. We were very smart about how we went about this. You know, we have a script that we can shoot for 50,000. We have one we can shoot for 100,000. We have one we can shoot for 150. We have a couple of scripts that are more like $250,000 budgets. We wanted to be prepared to have stories we could shoot for. You know, we decided to set the goal at the lowest possible place where we could produce something that we thought people would at least like, and that would be a quality piece. And then anything above that, we were prepared for as well.
But you have a huge pool of actors, you know, right across the different franchises. Have you chosen who's going to be in the pilot? Or is everybody in the room going, pick me, pick me?
Well, that's why I'm pushing so hard for the 200K and to match funds and to fund this whole series this year, because I don't want to let all these people down that have signed on. And of course, everybody wants to be in the first one. And I actually have a screenplay that could involve everyone. But it is rather, you know, it's more up at the 170, 175 or something. And it's a great screenplay. It's really fun. And it would be a great pilot, because you would get to see all of our actors, at least for a short moment, in about 10 of them for most of the episode. And then in the end, you get to see the rest of them for a few pages. But it's a really brilliant screenplay. It twists and turns, and it'd be a lot of fun to shoot. Otherwise, we know pretty much who's going to be. It depends. It all depends on how the Kickstarter goes and how the rest of the funding goes, who's going to be involved in the first show.
Well, it's gathering momentum, that's for sure.
Well, I think also, too, hopefully, you know, everybody understands that if we don't fund the entire series right off the bat, which I certainly hope we do, but that there will be an episode 2 and an episode 3, and we'll continue to make this. I've dedicated my, you know, the next 5 years of my life to making sure that this happens. So it's a matter of time, effort, energy,
Well, if you're a person who's willing to donate some money to the pilot, and the other people are hanging on to see what happens, they're going to be pissed when it goes really well and they didn't give their money to the pilot. So let's encourage everybody to support the pilot episode.
Yeah, it just, I mean, you said there's 50 million Star Trek fans out there. There's probably 200 million. There's probably more. There's probably an incredibly huge number of science fiction fans out there. And for us to fund the entire series, all I need is about 650 of you guys out there to sit down and make a pledge to the circuit and bring back intellectual positive science fiction to television. And you will love this show, and you picked the right thing to donate to. We've got incredible people behind this show, and we'll also make the dreams of a bunch of fans happen at the same time. It's going to be a blast. So.
Yeah. How long will each episode be, or will that be just determined by the amount of money you raise, or have you got a...
Right now, they're half an hour episodes. The ultimate goal is to have a deal with HBO, like I said, Amazon, Netflix, to make hour-long episodes. But right now, they're all written as half an hour.
Manu, I'm going to bring the interview to, sadly, to an end. We're running out of time. I just want to thank you for being on Continuing Mission.
Yeah.
The obvious question, and I'm sure people know this, but just to jog their memories, how can people find out more about the circuit?
Definitely go to @thecircuitmovie on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Like the pages, join us. If you really want to plug into the project, go join @thecircuitfangroup! On Facebook. We're doing a couple fun things over the next 2 weeks. We're going to do a Twitter storm this weekend from noon Pacific Standard Time till 4 p.m. And all the actors are going to be involved. So join @thecircuitmovie on Twitter and help us get We Are the Circuit trending and get the word out that way. And then on May 20th, we started the fan base, this man named Bill Morgan, called me and started this thing called We Are the Circuit Live, and started this thing called the Circuit Challenge, where he started to challenge all the different fan groups on Facebook that are into science fiction or sci-fi or Star Trek to do what people always say in crowdfunding. If everybody just sat down and donated $1 from these groups that have 300,000 people in them, we would have a beautiful science fiction series with, and nobody would have to give up anything but a dollar. That's always said, but it's never been accomplished. So on May 20th, we're doing the Circuit Challenge. And if you want to help the circuit get made, and if you're in any Facebook fan group that is into science fiction, Star Trek, etc., tell your admins, tell your members that May 20th at 12:01 a.m. for 24 hours, we are challenging all the Facebook fan club groups in the world to get their members to sit down, donate $1, then go to Kickstarter in the comment section, say what fan group that you're donating for, and we're going to track the top 10 fan groups that give the most money to this show, and we're going to give them special thanks in the credits. So that's we're going to try to make 100,000 people worldwide sit down and donate a buck to bringing, you know, conscious science fiction back to the screen.
Well, I'll buy that for a dollar.
Right on.
I'm going to a party soon, and I need to bring a gift. And I'm finding it really difficult to get a bottle of Koenig, this new scent that's come out. Do you know where I can get some?
Yeah, we were actually going to make it, and then we decided not to make it. I don't know why we did, but maybe we'll put that on as a special perk the last week of the campaign. We actually did spend some time thinking about whether people would want the Koenig cologne or not.
The scent of Walter.
The scent of Walter.
Yes. He carries it everywhere.
Oh, and everybody, this is something that we're really missing, is we haven't been promoting the Circuit Movie YouTube page, and all of our videos that we've shot over the, you know, our no budget videos there, but they're a lot of fun that we've shot over time to get people to at least know that this project was coming, are available to see there. And so that, and of course, go to Kickstarter and type in the Circuit Urbiesa. The circuit will get you there. and please pledge if you can.
Manu and Jeremy, it's been fantastic having you on Continuing Mission, and we wish you every success with the circuit, and we will do what we can to promote it from our end, no doubt. And I'm sure you'll get a fantastic response.
Thank you. Twitter storm this weekend, everybody. So not, what is it, 8 p.m. Your guys' time?
We're from, if it's 12, then it will be 8, yeah.
Yeah, so 8 p.m. your time.
It'll be 8 p.m.
8:13. We'll have a bunch of our actors at the Circuit Movie tweeting like crazy, and tune in and talk to us, and let's get the word out.
Well, Continuing Mission is goes out in the States more or less around 12 noon, so most people will be tuning in on time for that.
All right. Fantastic.
That was an absolutely wonderful experience to talk with Manu Inturaimi. Now, I just want to apologize for the sound quality there. It seems that the Borg were trying to get on our frequency and discover where Manu was, because they're still out to get him. And if we're not careful, they'll get us too. But anyway, while the Borg are busy seeking us all through the Alpha Quadrant, here at Trek FM, we've got a billion other podcasts for you to listen to. Here's a sample of what you may have missed across our network recently.
Previously on Trek.fm, Saturday Morning Trek.
He's like the little kid from the very last episode of Saint Elsewhere. Boba Fett and all this takes place in the head of Chewbacca's son. The whole panoply of Star Wars. It all takes place in Lumpy's head, all of Star Wars.
I think that we may have cracked the code of Star Wars altogether.
I think we did. Lumpy created Boba Fett.
Warp 5.
They never really do say what sport it is, right? We just assume it's baseball because he said doubleheader.
Well, he went to a baseball game with Herd, and he said baseball.
Baseball in Doylestown earlier. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right. Well, sorry, writers. You messed that one up then.
I don't even want to do this commentary anymore. Let's switch it to something else.
Melodic Treks.
Two things to say about that. The first is that Horner was really good at writing sustained cues. Always has been. You know, going back to some of his early stuff like Star Trek II, where you have the battle in the Mutara Nebula, you know, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
The 602 Club.
It's not subtle, but this is what happens. Ego is what happens when you only find meaning in yourself and you are truly all that matters.
And introducing our newest show, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The key thing with Jetrelli is all of these elements are exactly the same thing as the events in real life. You know, the Metreon Cascade is the bomb. Rhinax is Nagasaki or Hiroshima. You know, the poisoning is analogous to radiation poisoning and all these different things. And the parallels are enormously overt with Jetrelli straight away.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So now's a great opportunity to check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure and hit the subscribe button. That helps us out with ranking, and it makes it a whole lot easier for other listeners to find us in iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, well, we've still got you covered. You can find all our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/TrekFM, you'll find our current goals and milestone contribution levels there, along with all the great perks we have for you. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And don't forget the Babel Conference, which you can find on Facebook. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in. And you can join all the hot topics we discuss on there. We also invite you to leave a rating or a review of Continuing Mission on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. I can always be found on the Babel Conference on Facebook. And on Twitter, you can find me at Shamrock165. We would like to acknowledge the rest of the Trek FM team, without which this or any other podcasts would not be possible. See Brian Jones, our founder and publisher of Trek FM. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. And Aaron Harvey, our art director. I'm Tony Robinson, and thank you for joining with us today on Continuing Mission. And see you soon on the next mission.